Telling you, bro. What's been happening, bro?
Not too much.
Still hitting them more Peggy-ons.
Hey everybody, welcome back to Riff Raff. Greetings from beautiful Sapporo, Japan. I'm here in Japan right now with my wife and her family and hanging out. And I did a little work and recording and also now rest and relaxation. So it's been a while since I did a Riff Raff. Riff Raff, isashiburi kiite kurete arigato. Ima nihon ni kite imasu. So thank you for listening. There's some of my bad Japanese. I've had this episode in the can since August when I recorded it. Hall & Oates were at the Forum in Los Angeles, and my friend Greg Fillinganes came out backstage, hung out, hadn't seen each other in a while. We worked together with Boz Skaggs starting back in 2008 and just kind of hit it off. We became cigar buddies for a while. But I hadn't seen him in a while, and it was great to see him, and so he wanted to do this episode. I gotta say, it's probably one of the most favorite ones I've done so far. Nothing to do with me. Greg's stories are just unbelievable. Wait till you hear this stuff. I mean, for those of you that don't know, unless you've been living under a rock, wait, even if you have been living under a rock, you've heard these songs. I mean, you know, Songs of the Key of Life, Stevie Wonder, he joined the band when he was 18. Beat It, Billie Jean. He played on Off the Wall. He played on Thriller, Bad, classic Jackson 5 tracks even before that. He's worked with 3 out of 4 Beatles. He worked with George Harrison, Paul McCartney, Ringo Starr, Eric Clapton, David Gilmour, Phil Collins, Mick Jagger, Toto, Herbie Hancock, Donald Fagen. I mean, I'm just scratching the surface. So he's also been music director for many, many iconic artists, television shows. I think he's won an Emmy. You know, that's scratching the surface. So Greg agreed to do this, and it was really kind of a busy day for him. As you'll hear midway through the interview, I actually went with him to his chiropractor appointment in Studio City in Los Angeles because he wanted to keep hanging out. And the second half of the interview was done riding in the car, and it's got some great stuff. He talks about Eric Clapton and, you know, David Gilmour, and what it was like making Thriller with Michael Jackson and Quincy Jones. And you'll hear some amazing stories about George Harrison, all these guys. Anyway, I'm going to shut up. Thanks for listening. Let me know how you like this one. If you haven't already, give me a good rating on iTunes. There's plenty of other episodes now. We're on episode 31, which I can't believe. So I pull up to Greg's house, walk in, and he's getting some keyboard sounds. And his dog the dog wants to participate for a minute. But that's okay. He calms down. And here we go. Hope you enjoy.
Sound.
It's good, right? Okay, so here we go.
We're gonna get some dog breath on the podcast.
Yeah, well,
that's okay.
Just sit. Sit, alright?
Chill out.
Sit. You're gonna sit and you're gonna be cool, right?
Yeah, okay. You excited, huh? I know. Me too. Me too.
That's great.
Dogs are great, man.
Okay, look, come here. Sit down. Sit down. Sit. Sit. There you go. That's right.
Okay. All right, I am sitting in Los Angeles with the one and only Greg Feeling Gaines at his beautiful home.
What, is he here?
Hey, Greg.
Oh, hi, how are you? Hey, what's going on?
Talked him into doing this little podcast with me.
Yes, it didn't take much effort at all.
Well, thanks for carving out time.
Thank you.
And you're going to sit down, boy?
Yeah, this is my dog, Keeper, who decided to join us so he wouldn't bark at the wind downstairs. So if you hear any panting, it's not me. It's the dog. Okay. Just wanted to put a disclaimer out there.
Well, Greg showed up last night, played at the Forum last night.
With yes, sir.
Oats, and Greg was a VIP guest, made his appearance. And then I said, hey, man, what are you doing tomorrow? You know? And I hadn't seen you, man. It's been a long time.
Several years. Several years too many, as far as I'm concerned. But you were always so wonderful. And, excuse me, your lovely wife, you two invited my then-girlfriend, who's now my wife, Jory, you know, to your place in New Orleans. And we had traditional soba.
That's right. A traditional noodles. New Orleans
yes.
meal of Japanese cold soup.
Exactly.
I remember that. My mom was there. That's
yeah.
the last time I saw you, man.
Yeah, I think so. And but it was a wonderful meal that I still remember. And
that's nice of you.
So, yeah, absolutely.
You know, just a little backstory. I met you, Greg, when we were working with Boz Skaggs together.
For that yes, sir.
Summer. That was fun.
That was a blast.
Had a lot of epic cigar hangs.
You know, absolutely. They're very far and few between these days. I just rarely get to do it. Of course, having twin toddlers will do that.
Yeah.
But the cigar
smoke in the house is probably frowned upon.
You know, we don't do that. And I wouldn't want that anyway. But I rarely get the chance to go and have one. But, you know, whenever the opportunity hits, I'll do it for sure.
Yeah. Well, that time with Boz was fun, man, because, well, here. I'll refresh your memory.
Okay, let's see.
This is goofing off at sound check. Now I don't know if I have you. I don't think I have you singing. This is where we all switched instruments.
Yes, that's why it sounds so special.
No, I don't have. Greg does the best Boz Skaggs impersonation. I don't know if he'll do it here. Boz probably won't hear this. It doesn't matter.
You sure? Because I don't want to get in trouble.
You've got the best clutched tenor impression. How long, you know?
Well, the thing is, you just have to. You have to start forming your vocal cords. They just have to tighten up. They just have to tighten up a little bit, and then. But it's a fine line between Boz and Kermit. So you don't want to. You don't want to get Kermit. You don't want to do that because that's too much of an exaggeration. So what happens is when you just sort of, you know, tighten up just enough, you'll get into that range where it's like, babies didn't run around, hanging with the crowd, putting so your weird. Business in the street, talking out loud, saying you bought up this and that, how much you done spent, swear she must believe all heaven sent. Hey, boy. Better come on back around. The sad, sad truth. The dirty low down.
You know, and they sing the chorus and they go,
I done talk like that. You know.
Well, Greg would do this at soundcheck and Boz would just happen to show up and watch it. And
yeah, not good. Not good. He, you know.
You could get away with that, man.
Well, I
you
may, could maybe. Get away with it. Barely.
You know, really, the first time I ever met you, but you don't remember this because we didn't really talk for very long, was when you were the music director on Vibe, the Sinbad show.
Oh, yeah.
I played there with Aaron Neville. Where was that? CBS?
Oh, right. It was CBS. It was CBS, yeah.
And we did the taping, and I was
like,
it's Greg Feeling Gaines, man. And Quincy showed up, and I got a picture with Quincy that day.
Oh, yeah.
With Aaron. And
nice.
I was like, in awe, man. And then,
oh, cool.
So, anyway, here we are, like, God knows how many years later.
I know.
It's funny, huh? But man, you know, Greg, your resume is it's pretty ridiculous, as people listening to this know. So I don't know. I just thought I'd ask you some, talk about some of the, I won't say highlights, because man, there's, where do you start?
I have a few.
Yeah.
I have a few highlights for sure, yeah.
You started out, you're from Detroit or somewhere abouts there?
Detroit.
And then was it a drummer gave a tape to Stevie Wonder? That's how you kind of got out here, right?
That's the bare shell of the story. Okay. Yes, a very good drummer friend of mine who was first asked to audition for Steve in New York back in 75. That's 19 in 75. you know, and so the night before he left, I went to his house, obviously thrilled for him. And, you know, we were just both excited and he's packing and stuff and, you know, we're talking. But he insisted that I play some things on a cassette and he would deliver it to Steve. And so I thought this was incredibly generous and gracious of him. But that's just the kind of guy he was. And so I played some things. But I played a few songs of Stevie's the way he played them on his records to let him kind of know that I sort of know how he thinks. I can sort of relate to him musically. And I remember one of the songs I played was You Are the Sunshine of My Life. And I played it as close to the way he played it on his record, on the original recording. I played it as, you know, as close as I could. And I played a couple other things. Another song I played was Sun Goddess from Earth, Wind & Fire. That was popular at the time, that instrumental.
Yeah.
So I played a bit of that. And anyway, so my friend takes this tape the next day, and you know, a bit of time passes. I don't know how long, maybe 2, maybe 3 days. It seemed like an eternity. And then early one morning, my friend called me and said, Stevie wants to see you in New York today.
Wow.
That's exactly what I said. And so I go there and first of all, on the way to the airport, I'm instructed to stop by Stevie Wonder's house to pick up one of his brothers.
Wow.
So now I'm inside Stevie Wonder's house. I'm going, okay, well, this is kind of cool. I'm inside Stevie Wonder's house waiting to pick up his brother, Timothy. So we both go to the airport and, you know, land in New York, go to the hotel, get settled, and then go to the original Hit Factory. And I'm sitting there on pins and needles. I'm really trying to be cool and making small talk with the engineer, and I'm just waiting and waiting, and hours go by. And finally, the elevator door opens and you can see in the monitor him ambling out, you know, being led by his sister, Renee. You know, he walks in and they say, Steve, the kid's here, you know. And so he extends his hand and he says, hey, how you doing? And that handshake changed my life, you know. And we talked a little bit, had some small talk, and he showed me an unreleased track of his at the time. He wanted to know if I could play it, you know, reproduce it. And, so it was a tune called Spring High, and it ended up going to Ramsey Lewis, even though he said he was going to give it to me, but I'm not bitter. I'm not bitter. So anyway, this was the first unreleased song of Stevie Wonder's that I ever learned, and it goes like this. Take two. One more time.
Oh, come on, Greg. When's the last time you played this?
It's been amazing. A while. No, it's been a while. Okay. Okay, sorry. And take two. And 1, 2, 3. Well, you know, it didn't happen that fast. That was that night. And then the next day, was more of the formal audition. Mm. And that's where I met everybody else in Wonderlove, including Denise Williams, who was in the band at the time. And I remember she was very frisky. She would pass by me and pinch me on the butt. And nothing's changed. Like, to this day, I just saw her like a couple months ago. I did Dave Cosgrove's cruise, and she was one of the artists. And she came up to me and pinched me on the butt.
Oh, man.
So, and, you know, it was between me and this older-looking white guy that ended up being sent by Chick Corea. And I met him at a NAMM show several years back, and it turned out he was the guy, he was the other guy that was auditioning against me in Wonderlove. And
he was kind of the Pete Best of the...
Was he bitter about it? No, he was really sweet. His name is Mike. I can't remember his last name, but his name is Mike. And he's, when I saw him at NAMM, he says, you know, I'm that other guy. Now you're kidding me! So, so it was between me and him. And I was, you know, doing my best to hang, but every once in a while, you know, certain band members would come up to me and go, "It's okay, you got it, don't worry about it."
Mm-hmm.
And so then it's later in the evening, and I'm on my way back to the Hit Factory with Stevie, and we're both in the car, and he turns over and he says, "So, how does it feel to be a member of Wonderlove?"
Wow.
Just like that, and I went, "Are you serious?" He said, "Of course." Because, you know, I started thinking about all these stories I heard about him being a practical joker, and you never know if he's serious or not, because he could throw some crazy jokes on you. And I said, "Well, if you're serious, then would you mind telling my mom? Because I figured you're not going to lie to mom."
Right.
We get to the studio. I pick up the phone, dial the house, and hand the phone to him. And the first voice my mom hears is Stevie Wonder's telling her that he wants to have her son in his band, and he'll take good care of him and all that stuff. And this happened April 2nd, 1975, 1 month before my 19th birthday.
I was going to say, you were 18 years old.
Yeah, and 1 month before his 25th.
Oh, wow.
He was only 25 working on Songs in the Key of Life. So roll that around in your head for a minute. And unfortunately, my friend, the drummer, did not get the gig, but he ended up with Roy Ayers. And it is very important for you to know, and your listeners to know, that that friend of mine was Ricky Lawson.
Hmm. I didn't realize that.
Mm-hmm.
Well, he went on to do okay.
Yeah. Yeah. The only thing that's not okay is that he passed away.
Yeah, I heard that.
You know,
Steely Dan, that was one of his last gigs he was doing, maybe. That wasn't that long ago, right? Steely Dan gig?
I think so.
Last 10 years,
maybe. Yeah, I think so. I think so.
That's a story.
Yeah. I love him and miss him dearly. And I'm really mad at him because he didn't have to go. Ricky was the kind of guy. You heard of people that would give you the shirt off. He really literally would give you the shirt off of his back. And he cared about everyone else more than himself. Mm. And he was negligent in taking care of himself health-wise in later years. And so he suffered for that. But, yeah.
Now, you ended up... Did you play... You were on Songs of the Key of Life.
Four songs.
Yeah. What are those songs?
Well, I'm glad you asked that.
I kind of know Shane, the answer.
Let's see. There's one, yeah. One of them had to do with the fact that there's this crazy instrumental that actually was co-written by Michael Cimbello. And Michael did the bit in the bridge section that had this crazy jazz line, because he was heavily inspired by Pat Martino. Michael Cimbello was, you know. And so he came up with this crazy line that was just impossible to play, even on guitar, much less any other instrument. And turns out that Stevie couldn't play that lick. So I said, "Well, I can." So I ended up doing this.
Wow, there it is. Dinner. Yeah, there it is.
And there it is, so that line.
Yeah, man, I'm watching you.
You're watching me. Right,
wait,
this is
the shift there.
You know, in my younger days, I could have done that in one take.
You're still doing it, man. What are you talking about?
My younger days. So that's one song. Another song is... Another song is one of my favorites. It's just so beautiful. And baby, that's you. Made life history. You brought some joy inside my tears. Some joy inside my tears.
Nice, great.
Yeah, so I did the string parts on a giant synthesizer called the Yamaha Dream Machine. And, you know, it was a very intimate moment because it's really just the two of us sitting side by side on this thing, wagging our heads.
Man.
And, that's just, I'll never forget it. And then another one is, hanging my bed, going away. New and black, but the air is clean on Saturday. In the middle of the night. So I'm on that, and it's the same kind of thing, you know, we did, you know, sort of the orchestration part. And then the fourth song is a little ditty that celebrated a very special moment in his life. And I was there to be a part of it because my first 2 months in his band were spent in New York. And Steve had a fantastic brownstone apartment, you know, in the city and everything. And I remember going up to one of the floors and looking down into this crib and seeing this precious little baby. Mm. Next thing I know, there's a little song that came about as a result of that called Isn't She Lovely? Isn't she wonderful? Isn't she precious? Less than 1 minute, oh, I can't believe what God has done. Through us, He's given life to one so very lovely, babe. So that's me on Rhodes.
Yeah, man.
Yeah.
Classic.
Yeah.
Classic.
So
iconic.
So wow. Those are the four, my friend.
Wow, you're blowing my mind with this stuff, Greg.
It's pretty crazy, I have to tell you.
And that's what brought you out here to LA, and you've been here ever since.
Been here ever since, because what happened was, you know, again, the first 2 months were in New York, and that was April and May of 1975, and then in June it said, well, California is the place you ought to be. Mm-hmm. So we loaded up the truck and we moved to Beverly. Heels, that is. Swimming pools, movie stars. So anyway,
yeah, you're even doing the interludes for me. It's great.
Oh yeah,
the
oh,
bumpers
yeah.
and everything.
Oh yeah, because you know I'm a full service guest. You know, we take And if you ever have downtime and you have to, you know, switch equipment, you know, I can go. I can do
give
stuff
some
like
bumpers. Oh yeah, a little segue.
Sure. Anyway, so that's how that happened. And that's how I started.
Well, that's a... You were off to a running start. And when you got out here in L.A., in the that was 76, 75?
75.
Man, it was like a different world back then.
Oh,
right?
My goodness, yes.
Because I'm right. Every time I come here, I'm thinking, man, if I could have been here in the 70s, it'd be like a paradise.
Well, it was. And, you know, in many ways it still is. But it was so different for me because I had never been here. I'd never been to New York. I'm originally from Detroit. And I had experienced Europe at a young age. And I also went to Puerto Rico. So that was like the closest in geography to this, you know, right. As far as palm trees are concerned. Sure. You know, but I'll tell you, man, when we landed here, we left LAX and went right to a car rental place, like a luxury car rental place. And they said anybody with a license could get a car. So I ended up like driving this Mercedes. It was my first time driving a Mercedes. And I'm following the motorcade and we're like driving through Beverly Hills. And I'm looking up around at these palm trees in this gorgeous neighborhood. And I'm going, you know, I can get used to this.
Oh, yeah.
All right.
Oh, yeah.
And I've been here ever. That's 43 years ago.
Wow.
That's older than you've been alive.
No, it's not. Oh, but yeah, I was maybe a little toddler.
You were
back
a little
then,
toddler, yeah, sure.
I was alive. But man, I mean, I want to be conscious of the time. We could easily talk for 2 hours just on Stevie alone.
Oh, please, easily.
And I mean, it's like the ultimate buffet. I'm trying to like taste.
Get over
yeah, no, I don't want to, you know. I don't want to spin everything on the Chinese section. You know what I mean? So I got to move on.
Okay, we'll move on.
But
there's always part two.
All I got to say is a name, man, and we can do now. You know? Okay, so you're in L.A.
Yeah.
How did you get involved with the Jacksons and Michael Jackson?
Oh, that.
You know, Greg played on, the ones I know off the top of my head.
Yeah.
Thriller.
Yeah.
Are you on Off the Wall?
Yeah. Well, let me tell you how it started.
Okay.
It started with working with the Jacksons on Destiny.
Okay.
Doing rhythm arrangements. And the first rhythm arrangement I did for them upon meeting them was a little thing that went like this. Yes. And my whole inspiration for all that stuff was, what would Stevie do?
Mm-hmm.
You know, because I was still in this band. And I remember, you know, hiring a couple other band members and we just knocked that stuff out. And it was so much fun. And so that was my introduction, thanks to my dear friend Bobby Columbi, who was an exec there at
CBS. He's the one that discovered Jaco.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly right. And so he told me, you know, he says, you know, you need to get more into arranging. And I go, well, I don't know. I mean, I'd done some arranging, but... He said, I think you should do more of that. And I go, I don't know. He says, well, actually, I do know you should, and here's who you're going to be doing it with. Next thing I know, I'm in a room with the Jacksons.
Wow.
And that's what started it. And then, you know, based on, you know, having worked more and more with Quincy, the day came when I got the call to participate in the first solo record, which was Off the Wall. And so, yes, I did Off the Wall. And then... came back to do another Jackson's album, which was Triumph. And then after that, it was Thriller and Bad and Dangerous and, you know.
Man, my head's swimming with so many questions. When you did, like, for instance, Thriller,
yeah.
Okay, did Quincy give the studio musicians, how does he usually, because you've done a lot of records with Quincy, does he give a fairly long leash or is he pretty specific in what he wants? Or did you, like, for instance, any tune, did you just groove on stuff over and over until something felt right?
No. The specifics were from Rod Temperton.
Okay.
Rod's songs were extremely detailed, and every part Rod wrote, all those parts. Thriller, all those parts. All that layering, that's all from him, you know.
Wow.
And Quincy neither gave us a very long leash or he was never really restrictive. It was a very happy medium. And Quincy knew how to bring the best out of everybody. He understood everyone's strengths and weaknesses, and he always challenged everybody to be even better and set their personal bar higher. And he knew how to do that. And he never operated out of intimidation. He was always gracious and loving. And he always ate well, too. Mm. He always ate great food. Well,
that's important. And musicians are happy.
Yeah. Good food. Yeah, yeah. And just lots of laughs between him and the incomparable Bruce Sweden, engineer extraordinaire. It was just a blast, man. You know, and Michael with his crazy self.
Did Michael have a lot of input on parts and things too? Did he, would he go over and say stuff to you about making changes?
Well, I mean, on his songs, yeah, he was pretty specific as well, and he just wanted to make sure that the stuff grooved. You know, I remember on Bad, I believe, I was recording the song "Leave Me Alone." You know, that thing that goes. He just wanted it really, you know, really definite like that, and it, you know, I doubled it with the string sound too. Mm. So you, you know. And I remember him standing next to me grooving while I was recording the parts. He was just like, you know,
yeah.
And that was fun, you know. So yeah, I mean, a million memories there.
It's funny, man. This morning I went back to Melrose to get, I was telling you, I had to get this jacket thing, and I'm in the Uber and there's Beat It on the radio. And you're on Beat It, right?
I am. I'm on the bridges, playing like an electric piano. People always told me,
yeah.
So yeah.
And that was a long
time. And I think the strings too, I did since.
Wow. That stuff sounds so good, man. Even
it
today,
does. Yeah.
It doesn't sound dated at all. It's just the testament to the production and the arrangement and the musicians and the song.
Everything.
And
well, the engineer.
And Michael, of course.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah, everything. The mix sounds just amazing, man.
Well, what Bruce did at that time, he would record the rhythm section, 16-track.
Oh.
And everything else on 24. So you had that extra punch.
Because of the
space,
of the
you know, because there was more space on the 16-track, so it wasn't going anywhere. That was the foundation for everything else, and you know, that proved to be highly effective.
Is that JR or Ndugu on Beat It? Or you remember?
On Beat It or Billie Jean?
Beat It.
On Beat It. Jeez, I can't.
I can look it up. I was just curious if.
Yeah, Ndugu's on Billie Jean.
Okay.
That I know. Beat It. I can't remember.
Yeah, man. That's
why can't I remember?
No, I'll look it up. That's,
there are people that know that stuff like the back of their hands. You know,
there are people right now listening to this going, I can't believe you don't know that change.
Yeah, I know.
You should have your research done before you interview Greg Fillinganes.
Well, well, then you come and do it then.
You know, Greg, you've had the role of MD, music director, for long, many, many big time artists, you know what I mean? And it's of interest to me because that's my current role with Daryl and John.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and it's, I always pick other MDs' brains about, because a lot of what the gig is massaging egos, maybe helping people.
Absolutely.
Bring out the vision, but
psychology.
Can you, I'm asking you now, if you had to describe to somebody how to deal, because I've seen you do it, man. You're a master. There's a reason people hire you, because it's a comfort thing. Not only are you a brilliant musician, but it's more than that. It's like the psychology. You make an artist feel comfortable. I saw you work with Boz. You know, Boz doesn't do that with a lot of people. He's kind of difficult. you know? So, I mean, what do you think the secret to it is? Or is there a secret? Is it just a personality thing?
Well, it's 98% personality. There's no question about it.
Yeah.
Easily. There's a great amount of psychology involved. And adaptability to the artist's personality and their needs is paramount, really. It's quite important. But also the ability to deftly navigate your vision along with the artist's vision. And, you know, the most important thing you can be is honest. You have to be honest. And people smell bullshit a mile away. But if you're honest, that goes a long way. And honesty may sometimes involve telling an artist something they don't want to hear. And they may get pissed. But they will always remember that you were honest. You know? You know, the more time you spend with that particular artist, the more trust is involved. And there has to be mutual trust and mutual respect. Artist knows that you respect them and you totally support them and you want to make them feel comfortable and help them with their vision to the best that you can, then that goes a long way. I would say, but definitely honesty and not being afraid to admit when you're wrong. And this is the harder part, not being afraid to, you know, convince an artist that you're right.
Yeah, that's the trickiest one.
That can be tricky, and it depends on that artist's personality too. Depends on age, status, you know, amount of ego, you know, all that kind of stuff. And it's a case-by-case situation. Now, you know, there's no cookie-cutter approach to dealing with artists by far, because they're different. And you have to go into each situation with a clean slate, you know, and just trying to understand the personality of the artist you're dealing with and the dynamics involved and, you know, who their inner circle is, you know, who they trust.
So. Yeah.
And you want to be part of that. And so, I don't know.
Let's see, when you were MD for Michael Jackson, you did a bunch of the big tours, right? They
We did the Bad Tour, which was his... The Victory was when he was still with his brothers. And that was before me. But I did his first solo tour, which was the Bad Tour. And then I wasn't planning on doing the Dangerous Tour, but I was called in to do that literally at the last minute because things weren't working out with the guy he had. And I remember rolling up to Universal Studios, the movie studios. We had a huge set, you know, I was rehearsing for the Dangerous Tour. And I rolled up, like, I think 3 days before everything was to be shipped.
Wow.
3 days before the end of the rehearsals, you know.
Oh.
It was crazy. And a lot of tweaking and a lot of cleaning up to do. But yeah, it was like 2 or 3 days before everything was gone. And then I spent the, you know, certainly the next month at least tweaking more on the road, but it was crazy. But yeah, Michael was good to work with to a point, and then it got to a point where, you know, it was more difficult to get access to him. And things that I cared about, I started to realize that it didn't matter to him, and that was disappointing. So it got to a point where I couldn't continue on.
Oh no. That would be a phone call. Hang on.
Okay, man.
Who's this?
But anyway, so we're continuing this interview. Greg so generously said, "Well, you can come with me to my my appointment.
I got an appointment.
Ride in the car.
We're just
riding the car. So
We're in the car.
Car talk.
Car talk.
Man.
Okay.
Yes. I'm going to squeeze everything I can out of these minutes.
Okay.
Let's see. We talked about Michael, which we could keep talking about all that.
That was the basic general.
I have a lot of guitar players that listen to this.
Yeah.
I mean, you've worked with, man, I mean, Eric Clapton.
That's a guitar player.
David Gilmour.
That's another guitar player.
I mean, you know, and then all the great studio cats, you know.
Well, there's George Harrison. That's another guitar player.
Oh, sorry. I skipped over him.
Yeah.
I mean, you want to talk about, I don't know, what's it like working with Eric Clapton?
Well, I never, ever, ever imagined that my overall understanding and appreciation of the blues would come from a skinny white British guy. I can assure you that. And what I learned from him was just invaluable. And one of the biggest personal highlights for me was when we did 24 nights at Albert Hall. It was based off of... Yeah, no, it was crazy. I mean, because every year after, you know, when I joined his band, rather, after I joined, you do a series of shows at Albert Hall, and it started out as... Let's see. I think it started out as 6. And then another... The next year was 12, and the next year was 18, the next year was 24.
Wow.
And the 24 were based off of 6 shows of 4 different configurations. So there was the 4-piece for 6 shows. There was the big band for 6 shows. There was the big band and the orchestra for 6 shows. And there there was the blues band for 6 shows. So it turned out that because of Eric's graciousness in trusting me, I ended up doing 3 of the 6 nights with the blues band, and I was on organ. Do you know?
That's deep, man.
You know the pressure in trying to live up to that? And I don't even know why. I think it was because someone else wasn't available on organ, and I can't even remember who that other person was. It's really foggy, but I just remember being asked to play 3 of the 6 nights on blues in the band shows, in the blues band shows, and it was just incredible. So because of that, that means I did 21 nights.
Wow.
I did 21 of those nights. I did all the 4-piece, all the big band and orchestra, and half of the blues nights. So that's 21 nights. Yeah. Isn't that great?
And you're on, you're on a bunch of the records, but that track Forever Man?
No, I'm not on Forever Man.
But you're on that record, August, right? Was that?
Well, Forever Man, I believe, was on the Behind the Sun album.
Okay.
And I'm playing with Nathan East on Something's Happening, and I think maybe one more on Behind the Sun. And then Eric recruited Phil Collins to produce the August album. And Phil didn't know who I was, but I was brought in, I think, between Nate. Probably Nate brought me in. And I remember Phil, rather, was kind of hesitant about keyboard players because he felt keyboard players generally overplay. he didn't realize I actually had taste. So we got along just famously well. It was a love affair. At first sight, literally, and it was just the 4 of us.
Wow.
And, you know, we had Tina Turner come in to do backgrounds on one of the songs. I think it was called Hold On. And, you know, we did a song that was given to us by, Lamont Dozier. And, you know, we just did a bunch of cool stuff. And it was just so much fun. We had nonstop laughs. And we didn't want it to end. And finally, when the project was over... Oh, and by the way, I co-wrote a song, too. I co-wrote Tearing Us Apart. And...
But Clapton cut one of your songs, right?
He cut
Behind the Mask?
Behind the Mask. And it's funny that people think it's my song. But I actually got that song from Michael Jackson.
Wow.
And Michael wrote that with Ryuichi Sakamoto of the Yellow Magic Orchestra,
right?
And because it was an instrumental track called Behind the Mask, but he put this melody and lyrics to it, and it was like a Levi Stubbs of the Four Tops vibe, you know. And it was really funky and bluesy and cool and everything, on top of this really robotic Japanese instrumental track. You know, dun 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 dun. Dun, 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 dun. And he's like, "Who do you love? Is it me, babe?" You know, and he's just killing it, you know. And Eric ended up redoing that as well. But when that project was over, we didn't want it to end, and so Eric's manager saw dollar signs, so he devised a little regional tour in southern France, and, you know, a couple other places in Europe, and that's how that started. And Phil toured with us, and we also did Montreux.
Wow.
And then we came here and did an American tour, just the four of us, and we slayed.
Oh man,
we killed them, man. And we played like Madison Square Garden and the Forum here in LA.
Yeah.
And I was so excited to play the Forum because that meant I got to go in the Lakers locker room. And yeah, I stepped into the showers, and like all the showers are 8 feet tall. they're huge.
I didn't notice that last night. I was there.
Oh yeah, they're, hopefully they're still one of the shower areas with the original showers for the players. But it was crazy, and that was an incredible tour. But then, you know, Phil couldn't stay with us because he had this other little band that he had to go back.
Yeah, his little side project.
Yeah, that little side project. So he was dealing with that, and but. No, we just had so, and then the band grew a little bit. We got Steve Ferroni to replace Phil. And
he doesn't suck.
He does not suck, my friend. So yeah, it just, that was the beginning of that experience, and then I'm also on the Journeyman album, which is just one of my favorites of all time, and that was such a powerful record to me, you know.
Yeah,
fantastic, man. Songs, and just, you know, and the tour, the Journeyman tour, was also pretty special.
How long would you go, what would be the longest you would go out for, like a major tour like that, one stretch? Would it be like 6 months or something?
Oh yeah, easily. When I was with Michael, easily. And the bad tour was, I don't know, it was a long one. It was at least 18 months, but not consecutively. I mean, there were some breaks, but
yeah.
It's a long tour, you know. So it's funny, I hear musicians talk about, man, I got to go out for 6 weeks. I go, man, I spit on 6 weeks. I'm just getting started.
Yeah.
But I've since stopped touring. I just can't stand being away from my family for long periods of time. And I've done it, man. I mean, please.
I get it.
Who totally. Else is there to go with?
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, exactly. What else are you going to do? I just thought of something. Will Lee is a give him a shout out because he listens to the podcast. Hey, Will.
Will, what's up, baby? You know,
and
I love you.
And I asked him about the Nightfly, which I believe you played on the Nightfly.
I believe
as well.
You got
any stories about those sessions where it was Donald Fagen? Are they? I know they're notoriously picky and finicky. And
Well, I have several. Sort of... I have several stories. Well, okay. Here's the thing. Think about, because I knew going in about, you know, how notorious Donald and Walter were for just abusing musicians and just literally taking the piss on them, and musicians walking away from those experiences like it was a badge of honor. It's like, yeah, man, I got abused by Walter and Donald. It's great, you know. But they did crazy stuff, like, you know, a kick drum sound for a week. Because they could.
Yeah.
They knew they could do that. And musicians were actually, you know, hungry to do those kinds of insane things. Then I'm sure Donald and Walter would just sit back and laugh. I can't believe we pulled this shit off. You know, like, we can do crazy stuff like this. And these guys would take it. But so I Gary Katz, I don't know how he got in touch with me, but he called me in to do the Nightfly project, which was, you know, Donald's first solo record. And again, I went in, you know, kind of being mentally prepared for what could happen, but it never did. Donald was really gracious, and he actually let me get away with several liberties, you know. Like one thing, on the Goodbye Luck, for instance, the intro, the way it starts off, he wanted me to do a marimba solo. Mm. And so I did several takes, and the last two he liked. So we played the second to the last take, and then we played the last take, and he couldn't make up his mind. So I said, well, let's put them together. Borrowing from an old trick that Stevie did when he did the dual harmonica solo in Too High. Mm. So I said, let's just play them back together. So he did, and he liked it. And that's why there's two marimba solos on that. On IGY, which was the first thing I ever played on, the first song from the project I ever played on, it was just me and the drum machine that they called Wendell. And it was just me on this Rhodes piano. And it was such a gorgeous sound. And the song was fantastic, you know. It was just hauntingly beautiful. And I remember loving it so much that I would go through the entire song, and then just near the end I'd mess up and say, oh, sorry, can we start again? Like, I would mess up intentionally. I just wanted to keep playing it.
Wow.
And
that's a great track.
And it really is. And then everything else was built on top of the Rhodes. Maxine, everybody thinks that I came up with the intro, but nope. Sorry, folks. It was all Donald. That was all written note for note. But at the end of it, there's several changes at the very end, and Donald's holding a note vocally and just the background and everything. And I just got hit with the spirit, and I just started playing wildly over all the changes, just soloing, and I couldn't help myself. I just launched into this, you know, intense playing over all the changes at the very end, and he kept that.
That's why cool, I do this podcast. Who's ever going to know this stuff?
Who cares?
A lot of people care.
Okay, fine. Well, for those of you who do, that's what happened. And then another thing, when we did Walk Between the Raindrops, mm-hmm. he wanted me to play an upright bass sound on the synth. So I was like, cool, you know. So I started playing it, and he actually stopped and said, no, play like this. He actually instructed me to take physical breaths between each note to replicate the spacing of an upright book. And that's what I did, and that's why it sounds like that.
Brilliant.
Isn't that crazy?
Yeah. Where were those sessions? In L.A. or in New York?
No, New York.
New York.
I flew to New York, man, and hung out with him. We went to a club, man. He took me to a club to see Roy Haynes. That was the first time I ever saw Roy Haynes. And
As a matter of fact, it might have been that same club, but that was the last time I saw Jocko. Jocko stumbled in, and he was all jacked up. He was drunk and everything, and he was like, ranting and everything. And it was really kind of sad, but that was the last time I saw Jocko.
Man.
Hanging out with Donald Fagen.
I want to be you when I grow up, Greg.
Oh, no, you don't. You want to be infinitely better.
No, man.
Trust me, Sugar Shane and all those listening, it ain't just, you know, I'm telling you really incredible, glitzy, glamorous stories, but for every one of those stories, I got 20 not-so-good stories.
Yeah, well, they're still above average stories.
Yeah, you know, I'll give you that. I'll give you that.
Yeah. Oh man, are we at your place?
We're close, but we're gonna keep going.
This is awesome, man.
No, I'm gonna tell you what. This won't be enough. No, this won't be enough, because if it's not enough, after my appointment, we'll drive some more.
No, this is a no.
No, listen, we haven't even scratched the surface. You know this. You do know this, right?
I do know this. Okay. And you know, I want to be respectful of your time.
No, it's fine, man. You're a good friend, and I haven't seen you in way too long. And we said we wanted to hang out, so what better way to hang out than this? Driving around my town. In my car. Yeah,
this is really great.
On my way to my physio appointment. But you know, it doesn't get much better than that.
That's from playing all them voices. All them voices. Like Max, them voices.
That's funny.
Voicings, Max.
Yeah. Well, voicings. It's the same. Voices.
Who are some of the fave studio cat guitar players you like? Since I got a couple guitar players listening to this. I mean, the Paul Jackson Jr.,
Michael Thompson for sure. Steve Lukather, absolutely.
Yeah, man.
Dean Parks, God, the guy can play anything and has. My main man, Jay Graydon.
Hey, man. Hey, man. How you doing, man?
He's sort of been retired a long time, right?
No, just more reclusive. Not retired. He's just turned into not Hugh Hefner, but the guy that...
Howard Hughes?
Howard Hughes, yeah. But no, he's still around. I hadn't talked to him in a while. It's been like... So those are, you know, some...
Yeah, that's the creme de la creme.
Yeah, I would say so.
Yeah, man. Yeah. You know, I know exactly where we are. We're up by Sportsman's.
Yeah, see?
I ate at one of these restaurants with Harry. I was here. I did this Spinal Tap thing with Harry Shearer.
Uh-huh.
Right? And rehearsed, and we ate at one of these places. Might have been this.
Huh, see?
It was like a few months ago.
It's crazy.
But anyway, when I met you briefly when you were doing the Vibe show, it was the guy Toshi.
Toshi Inagi.
And he's with Jimmy...
he's on the Kimmel show.
Yeah.
But I love him. He's also very tasty. And, you know, his work ethic is unparalleled. I mean, you give him an assignment, man, and he'll come back and it'll be exactly what you need and better. Because we were doing a TV show, so, you know, you had to learn a wide variety of genres in a short period of time, and he always did his homework, and he always came prepared, and he would reproduce exactly what I needed, and I loved him for it.
Now, when you were MDing a show like Vibe, that's back before email was as, you know, but would you write out charts, or how would you do that, MD?
I'd have a librarian, you know, and she would distribute the songs, and... yeah, there were charts involved, but many times it was just listening to the original and just getting a vibe and doing it on the spot. Because we wouldn't have to play entire pieces unless we were backing up a guest artist.
Uh-huh.
Right? So, outside of that, it was just snippets of favorite songs of... Yeah, bumpers. Favorite songs of ours that... Oh, there it is. That... you know, we had permission to do. There it is. So that's what we would do. And everybody was, you know, really fast study, quick learners, and so skilled. Like, you know, we had Alex Al on bass and Terry Lynn Carrington on drums.
Wow, I didn't know she was playing drums.
Oh, shoot, yeah. And not only did she play, she sang. So, and Peter Michael, crazy Peter Michael, Sheila E.'s brother on percussion. So I had the best band on late night TV. Sorry.
Yeah, that was a great show.
Short-lived, unfortunately. Yeah. But guess who did our last show?
Who's that?
Prince. So
they talk about going out with a bang. There you go.
Yeah, that guy. Oh, let me tell you about that guy. So when I first got the gig on Vibe, one of the artists I wanted to play a lot of, obviously, was Prince. But we were told early on that we could only play 1999. So I would just play the hell out of that every chance I got, right? So then all this time passes, and then now it's time for our final show. And so Prince is the artist. And I say to him, man, he actually paid me a compliment. He says,
I really like the way you do 1999. makes me want to do it like that, too. Because we would do it like the, original tempo or whatever. I said, well, I appreciate it, but I'm just doing it the way you did it on the records, I said, by the way, man, I wanted to play a whole lot more of your stuff, but, I didn't have permission. He goes, you could have played whatever you want. I'm like, well, now you're telling me. And I said the same thing. I said the same thing to his attorney, Londell, and he says, oh, no, you could have played. But I'm like, well, no.
You would have done it, and you would have got a cease and desist.
Exactly. So, needless to say, I was highly frustrated about that. Oh, such is life.
I just thought of a funny story. Greg's pulling his appointment, but I got to tell you. You remember we did that gig with Boz at Canyon Club, and David Page was coming to sit in, and you said, hey, Sugar Shane, help me play a joke on David Page. Let's flip all his keyboards upside down and try and flip the stool upside down. And
did
when he
I
gets
do
here,
that?
Yeah, and you said, he'll think it's funny. And I'm thinking, all right, man, whatever. So we flipped all his stuff upside down.
Did that really happen?
Yeah, we did it.
Oh,
it happened.
Goodness.
Yeah.
I was really crazy.
That's a tight parking spot.
It's tight in there.
Well, it looks like this dude's leaving.
Oh. Perfect.
Well, I'm trying to think where we left off. You were talking about Eric Clapton. And then David Gilmour. I mentioned David Gilmour.
Yeah. Well, I can certainly talk about him.
Whatever you want to talk about, that would be great. I don't know a lot about David Gilmour, actually. I'm a fan, but...
Yeah, well, one of the cornerstones of Pink Floyd. Innovative, brilliant, soulful, quietly passionate, wonderful guy. I met him, in the early days with Eric, and I remember my first Floyd experience was seeing them live at the Palace of Versailles.
Wow.
Okay, these guys don't know how to putt, man. They had their genius lighting designer, Mark Brickman, who I didn't know who he was. I didn't realize he was the one that was behind all this stuff until years later. But, man, Mark Brickman is a genius. This guy was crazy enough to light the entire Palace of Versailles in pink. I saw it myself. It was and this is while I was on tour with Michael. And then my second encounter with them was, I think, Texas Stadium. They played a stadium, and I remember hanging out with David and some other folks. We were perched way up high someplace in a room overlooking the entire stadium, and we were watching the crew tear down. I had met him, through Eric in my early days with him. Mm. And we hung out a little bit and talked very little, stayed in touch very, very little. But, I had his number, and we would talk every once in a while. But not very often at all. And then many, many years, we just lost touch. And someone emailed me and said that there was a guy who's the manager of Jules Holland who wanted my contact information. So I thought, all right. So I gave it to him. Next thing I know, I get an email from David saying, right, it's been an age. Fancy a tour. I'm like, first of all, how did you even find out? How did you even remember me? How did you even find... And I was absolutely blown away, and I thought, okay, this is another one of those crazy examples of, I don't want to tour anymore. Besides, who else would I tour with? Well, you really going to turn down a tour with David Gilmour? No. So that's how I spent my summer 2 years ago.
That was 2 years ago?
Yeah.
I didn't realize it was that recent.
Yeah.
Wow, man.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Well, that is a good summer.
Yeah, that didn't suck
too bad.
I'm
sure it was pretty cush treatment.
Cush? Well, we had our own jet. And it wasn't a little rinky-dink four-seater. I mean, it was massive. And there was first class and Uber first class.
Yeah.
And
not that I know, but I'm just saying. Yeah, I'm sure it was.
And you know, we usually sat in the first class section, but I did sit in the Uber first class section once with David and his wife. And there's like this in the middle of the plane, there's like a whole area that's sectioned off, and that's the bedroom.
Wow.
And there was an actual bed in there and everything. Wonderful plane. And we were always met with a fleet of Mercedes SUVs that, you know, took us from the tarmac to the hotel, and the hotel to the, I mean, it was crazy. It was awesome. And, you know, we didn't play like just rinky-dink arenas like the normal kind
of course
stuff. He did arenas during the American portion of the tour, but that was before I joined. You know, he played the Garden, and he played the Forum, and he also played the Bowl. But that was, again, before I joined. When I joined, it was just for the European leg, but we did places like, you know, Circus Maximus. And, you know, the Colosseum in, where Mount Vesuvius is. Where is it? I know what we're going to do. We're going to park in Whole Foods. That's what we're going to do.
Was it mostly, was it a mix of American and English musicians, or were you the only American guy?
No, there was Steve DeStanislau on drums. Fantastic drummer. Great guy. Lovely guy. And we had British background singers, and the irascible Guy Pratt.
Oh, Guy Pratt. He played bass
for on bass, time. Yes. And, okay.
Oh, that's a great shot. Yeah. He's showing me a shot of David Gilmour.
Yeah, in the Coliseum, but I can't. Wow. We'll tell you the name of it in a second. And then that was it by day, and then this is them working on the lighting at night. And then, wait. That's the final part.
Wow.
Come on.
Wow.
Come on.
Wow.
Wait, I'm gonna get.
I wish I could.
I'm gonna get to the punchline of this, and then you're gonna really be impressed. Okay, so here we are at Whole Foods. You need anything?
Whole Foods, no.
Okay.
Right by the 405.
Right by the 405. See, it's freeway close. Hang on, we'll just find a place to park.
Perfect spot.
It's good, right?
Got some good parking, Carver, today, Gray.
Yeah, that's pretty good, right? Oh, should I park it? No, I won't park here. I'll leave that for someone else.
Very thoughtful.
Well, you know. Happens that way. Could be a blessing to somebody else. So now, we will do this, and we will park in the shade.
In the shade.
Huh? How about that? That's how we do it. Okay, so now, wait a minute. Pompeii!
Oh, Pompeii.
It was Pompeii. Okay. It was the Colosseum in Pompeii.
Because you did a recording, right? Or video or something.
Yes, we did a video of it. And the reason why is because the last time David played Pompeii, it was a live concert with no audience. And it was Pink Floyd did a whole film there. But they didn't bring in an audience. And then the only other time there was an event there, gladiators were involved.
Which was a little ways back.
So I go to Pompeii, and in the catacombs in the underneath the Colosseum is a whole exhibition on Pink Floyd.
Wow.
So this is me standing in the Colosseum with my straw hat, because,
nice
you know,
brim.
You had it, well, you know, that's David rocks a brim, so I wanted to be like him, so I got a straw brim. And then, and this is on the grounds there. Mm. And this is the entrance of the exhibition. And it's completely dedicated to Pink Floyd.
Museum.
Yeah. It's like a whole museum and the artifacts and stuff, and it shows you the empty Coliseum and how they set it up for the band back then. And see Pink Floyd live at Pompeii. Except there was no audience. Only they could do some crazy stuff like that. And there's this whole, see, the whole story, the making of every, and that's the, you know, the whole walkway. And it's, this is on each side of the Coliseum.
Wow.
A very young, sexy David, you know. And this is a shot of them, you know, during the filming. Home. And I just took all these pictures, man, and it was fantastic.
I didn't realize it was that recent. 2 years ago. 3 years ago.
Yeah. What, my tour? Yeah, it was
2016,
2 years ago.
It must be nice to just say, you know what? I'm going to put a band together. I'm going to call my friend Greg, Phil and Gaines. I haven't seen forever, and I fancy a tour.
It's been an age of fancy tour. Actually, that wasn't him.
And, you know, money's not an issue, I'm sure, for him. So well, just get the best cats.
Well, it was. Well, he does have a manager, and his manager is very much, you know, dedicated to saving
pounds.
Pounds, because he knows how crazy David can get. But, no, it was a good time. It was a good tour. And, you know, I was young. Mm-hmm. Lauren. But, it was just incredible. I mean, it really, really was. And, oh, you're gonna like this. I want to show you how they took care of me, how Mark took care of me. And by the way, that's Mark Rickman.
Oh.
The most unlikely looking person to be the mad lighting genius that he is. But that's... let's see. I want to show you how he lit me for a specific part of the show. Well, first of all, this is how we were all lit.
Oh, wow. Man, that's beautiful.
Look at that.
That's
now there, that's the money shot right there. That's the Colosseum, and that's Mount Vesuvius in the background. Pretty spectacular.
That is unbelievable. That's great shots.
And look at this.
Wow.
And there I am. There's your boy right there in the corner.
It's like a dream catcher or something. There you go.
Yeah, there I am.
There you go.
But wait, you see how I was lit. And then I'll tell you the song that I was lit for. It's going to blow you away. I was lit like this.
Mm.
Do you know what that's for? The intro to Shine On. Now imagine the intro in your head and look at that. And that's me doing the whole synth intro. That's how he lit me. And you know I milked it, man.
Like, I'm sure you did.
Cow. Every second I just totally
basking in it.
Yeah, basking in it. And so that's, yeah. But yeah, it was just incredibly enjoyable and, you know.
Nice work if you can get it, folks.
Nice work if you can get it, you know, that sort of thing. But we played one place that was a backdrop for a Bond movie. That was this castle and this, you know, incredible grounds, you know.
Worked on a Mick Jagger record, right?
I worked on a Mick Jagger's.
Cool.
Yeah, Primitive. And I think that was his first solo record, right? Yeah.
I don't know. I think so. But yeah, what was he like to work with? Is he cool?
He was really cool. And I was brought in by Dave Stewart.
Oh, wow.
So I'm in a room with Dave Stewart and Mick, and they were just cool. They were just straight ahead, really cool, unassuming, and fun to work with. And the cool thing about Mick is I believe he remembers me to this day because of that.
Yeah, I'm sure.
And, you know, Mick is just a cool... I have great respect for Mick because, you know, he's one of those guys that should have been dead 15 times. But, you know, he takes touring seriously. He takes incredible care of himself. He has no body fat whatsoever. Last time I saw him, I said, dude, you have no body fat at all. And he's just slim and svelte, and, you know, he takes it seriously, and he does what he has to do to prepare for the big tours. But it was great work with him for the little time I did. It was wonderful.
Have you ever gotten, I'm going to go way off.
Ask me anything.
Have you, and you don't have to mention names, but okay. Have you ever been on a session and work with an artist where something went wrong and you just left? Walked out of a session.
No, Jeff Porcaro walked out of a session.
The Rick Lee Jones one.
Yeah. But no, but I've had some challenges, but you know what? I can't even really remember them. Because there weren't many. That's
yeah,
for sure.
Well, your personality, I don't see how it could escalate to that, but.
No, I just really tried to reverse the dynamic that I learned about. In other words, the first time I went to work with... No, not actually that. The first time. It was the second time that I worked with Paul Simon. Paul Simon. Please edit this.
No, I thought you were going to say Paul McCartney. Yeah, you could be anybody.
No, well, yeah, yeah. No, but I worked with him too. But Paul Simon, you know, I was working on, let's see, it was Rhythm of the Saints. And Roy Halley was, you know, producer, engineer. And I remember Roy sort of giving me a heads up that, you know, Paul's really... You know, he can be temperamental and, you know kind of like giving me a heads up to tread lightly kind of thing. And I just thought, well, you know what? Thanks. But I just made up my mind that I was going to charm the pants off of him. And that's exactly what I did. And the first day was the first day, and we got along just fine. And I kind of broke the ice because, you know, it was like this kind of underlying tension. And it wasn't anything really intense, but there was an underlying tension, and I just decided I was going to break the ice and just try to make him feel as comfortable as possible. By the second day, he came in and he made popcorn. Made popcorn for me, like we're hanging out, meaning his popcorn. So, you know, just like the story about Donald Fagen, I just decided I was going to not be... victim to the stories I'd heard about, you know, and just try to change things to where, you know, we would make the experience more enjoyable.
Well, that answers that.
Okay.
Tell my thoughts. Yeah, I mean, I was just curious because.
Yeah, I mean, there were some. Every once in a while, there was a really annoying producer who would. I think those were the ones that. Would irritate me. Like every once in a while, there'd be a producer who, you know, wanted to act like he knew what he was talking about and didn't have a clue, and you know, trying to posture himself as, you know, being of some great importance, and excuse me, and or just talking in weird terms, like I needed to sound more yellow.
Yeah.
And you know, your mission. As a session musician is to interpret that and reproduce it in a way that, you know, works for the producer. But no, there weren't too many times in those, fortunately.
Is there anybody that you haven't worked with that's still alive? Maybe that, I mean, I can't imagine who you haven't worked with, but
that's still alive. I don't think so.
Yeah. Well, that's not surprising.
That's kind of crazy, isn't it? But, I mean, I never got to work with Prince.
Mm-hmm.
He had me sit in with him at a club in London one time after a show. I went to this club because I heard he was going to be there, you know, doing an after show set. And I go in and I find... Bonnie Boyer, one of his keyboard players. We just got totally
lost in this conversation. We were totally engaged and, you know, having a wonderful time. It was during a break, and I didn't notice anyone or anything else around me. You know, we were just totally engrossed in this conversation, and we were sitting at the edge of the stage. All of a sudden, I feel this little wet, clammy hand take my wrist, and I look up, and he says, "I know you. You want to play?" I went, "Okay." Next thing you know, I'm on stage with Prince.
Wow, man.
And we're playing, like, you know, top old soul classic hits, like "I'll Take You There" and stuff, and "Just My Imagination" and all this kind of thing. And at one point, you know, he's playing, and he walked over to me and sat next to me while playing, and I thought, well, this is kind of cool.
So you did sort of work.
I sort of, well, once.
I mean, you played music with him.
I played music with him one time. So that was, that was pretty cool.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, I never even got to meet John, but I can say that I've worked with 3 out of 4 Beatles.
Not many people can say that.
Yeah.
I don't know anybody except maybe Jim Keltner.
Yeah. Jim can say he's worked with all of them, but, yeah, 3 out of 4. Because I played a Grammy segment with Ringo. We did Photograph at a Grammy some years ago, and it was around the time that the Beatles were being honored. They did a Grammy TV special honoring the Beatles, celebrating their 50th anniversary of their appearance on The Sullivan Show. And, you know, Don was the band, was the MD. And I basically just willed myself in that band. I said, "Don, you're going to hire me for that show. I'm doing that show. I'm just letting you know I'm doing the show." He's like, "Really? What do you mean, do I want to do that? Are you crazy? Of course I want to do it." So,
he was backstage last night, by the way.
Don?
Yeah.
Well, when did I missed him?
Yeah.
He was what?
Back there hanging out, though. Yeah.
Oh, that's so crazy.
But, well, that's cool, man. Yeah.
So I did that, and, you know, the feeling of, like, after this, or let me just explain this. After that show, after the taping of that show, because it was with, you know, obviously, Paul and Ringo, and at the end of it, all of us stood in sort of like a receiving line, and they thanked each and every one of us. They came and shook our hand. Now, you have to understand, I'm standing there looking at Paul McCartney and Ringo Starr thanking me for participating in their celebration of their 50th anniversary of their Sullivan appearance. And I'm going, no, you don't understand.
It's sort of backwards, right?
You don't really understand right now what is happening to me. I'm quaking in my skin because I saw you when I was 8 years old on Sullivan, and I never, ever imagined that I'd be standing here listening to you tell me thank you. Do you understand what is happening to me right now? And it was just otherworldly. It was just so surreal. Wow. It's one of a million blessings that I thank God for every day. But, you know, it's just crazy. It's crazy. And then, of course, touring Japan with George, with Eric, it's just like, really? So, Eric convinced George that, you know, he should do a little tour, and he said, "Well, you can use my band." So next thing you know, we're all together, and we pull up to Tokyo, and we're at the Capital Tokyo Hotel, which I don't even think exists anymore, and we're all in George's suite, and the TV's on, right? And on the TV, they're showing footage of when the Beatles pulled up to the exact same hotel we're staying in. And I'm sitting there, and I'm looking, and I'm going, okay, wait a minute. I'm sitting here in the suite of a Beatle looking at footage of when the rest of his band pulled up to the same hotel that we're in now. This is crazy.
That is crazy.
But you want to hear something even crazier?
Sure.
Right. So, like, George became a buddy, like a buddy of mine. And I had visited him twice at his house. And the second time, you know, I let him know that, and by the way, he also hung out with me, or I hung out with him, rather, when he came to L.A. once. And I have to tell you that quick story. So I picked him up. I don't remember where he was, but I picked him up, and we're driving down La Cienega to go to a restaurant in Beverly Hills because he loves Indian food. Mm. And he wanted to go to a place called the Bombay Palace. And I knew where it was, but I, you know, I'm not an Indian food fan, but I, when George Harrison says he wants to, yeah, I was that day. So, we go there and we just had a nice little meal. And so every time I pass the Bombay Palace on Wilshire in Beverly Hills, I go, the only time I was ever in there was with George Harrison. Mm. So then, the last time I visited him at his house, we're hanging out, and he met me at the door. He opens the door, and there he is standing there with cornrows in his hair. I'm like, really? I didn't expect this, look, George. I'm like, how did you even get this?
Yeah, who did this?
Who did this? You're like wearing corn. He goes, what do you think? I go, actually, you're pulling it off pretty well. I mean, I really did not see this coming, like George Harrison and cornrows. I wish to God I took a picture, but I don't know why I didn't take a picture.
Oh, God.
But this, so funny. George and cornrows, I'm like, okay, well, this is different. So we're hanging out. And at some point later on, he goes, right, do you want to hear the new single then? And I go, okay. Next thing you know, I'm in the bedroom, and I'm sitting down on the floor, and he puts the tape on, and the next thing I know, I'm hearing, freak! As a bird.
Oh, yeah.
Da, 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 me. And I'm sitting there, and I'm transfixed because I'm trying to wrap around in my mind that I'm at the home in the bedroom of a Beatle, sitting on the floor listening to the last single that they ever did. And I'm having my own world premiere of it. And it was just
that's
like...
That's unbelievable, man.
I can't begin to tell you the... I don't know how I lasted, but yeah.
Wow, great.
Yeah.
You crazy. Have to write a book, man.
I keep hearing that, and I don't know. I mean, maybe I will. I don't know.
I think a lot of people would love to read it. I would, for sure. Yeah.
Well, yeah.
Man, that's a... pretty amazing life, man. And it's still getting more and more amazing.
Yeah, it is. But I believe me, for every one of those stories, I got 10 really bad ones.
Yeah, I get it. But, well, man, I think I have plenty. Like, it's almost okay. Overwhelming the amount of cool shit I have now.
Okay. Yeah.
I mean, I know we could go on and on. But,
oh, boy.
But I appreciate your time, Greg.
Well,
it's
thank
so
you.
Great just hanging with you, man.
It is great hanging with you.
It's been
my
too
goodness,
long.
It's been way too. That's why I wanted to do it. That's why I just decided we have to. And this is a rare, an extremely rare moment. I mean, my wife and kids are gone. They've been gone all day.
It is,
and
rare.
So this is really rare. So I believe this was God ordained. So I'm just happy see you, man. And I hope the interview works out, and I
said, oh, it's gonna work
I
out.
I can make some kind of sense at the end.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. I sat with Greg at his chiropractor appointment.
Come on, man.
Thought up some new questions for you while you were getting adjusted.
Yeah.
It's life's great. Pretty cool, man.
Not bad.
Not bad.
You know? And you got a scone out of the deal.
I got a great scone.
My wife's homemade scones, yeah.
You know? It's soba, and then a few years later, I get a scone.
See?
And then now I need to reciprocate at some point, whenever I see you again.
Okay, you got it.
Or I'll take you to dinner next time.
Okay.
Know any good Indian restaurants?
Let me think about that. Well, I love you. Thanks so much.
Oh, yeah, man.
It's been
thank
great.
You, bro.
All right.
Hey, everybody. If you're still here, I hope you enjoyed that. I mean, there was some great stuff in there with Greg. I really enjoyed that hang. It put a big smile on my face hearing it again a few months later. So once again, if you like what you hear, drop me a note. Give me a good ratings on iTunes. Check out some of my solo records. Check out some of the other episodes on the podcast. Got a lot of great people on there. Last one was Sammy Hagar. I don't know who will be next, but we'll see.